This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando has a new city commissioner in District 6. Bakari Burns defeated Gary Siplin in a runoff election last week, a resounding win in a race that nonetheless saw only a few thousand votes cast. Burns may be new to politics, but he grew up in the district and he says he has his finger on the pulse of the big issues, including housing, transportation and infrastructure needs. Burns, who leads the non-profit Orange Blossom Clinic, says he'll spend the first few months of his term listening to residents and figuring out how to represent the needs of the entire district. Well, Bakari Burns, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And congratulations on your win in the election for District 6. What are your goals for this district? What do you see as the biggest challenges, first of all, and what do you think you can achieve in the first, say, 90 days in office?
Right, so I think a lot of the challenges for the district are really what I call some quality of life type of issues. So we have a very diverse district. So there's some concerns in one part of the district that the other part of the district may not have. But within the first 90 days, if you will, I'll really be focusing on communication and kind of engagement, because throughout the campaign, I continue to hear that a lot of the residents just didn't have the information. They say they would get information late or not at all. So I want to empower the neighborhood associations and the homeowners associations, help get them organized, re-energized, and provide them the information so I can have a direct connection to the district. So I will know all the time what they're facing, some of their ideas. So first, that'll be, again, that period of engagement and communication are some of the things that we'll be focusing on, in the first few days.
Have you had a conversation with your predecessor to kind of get the lay of the land?
No, he called me to congratulate me, and we did say that we'll sit down and have coffee and just talk. But, with me growing up in the district, when I returned from Tallahassee and moved right into the district, I worship in the district. So I'm connected. So I know a lot of the issues, but I don't profess to know everything. Mm-hmm. So we'll sit down. I'll hear some of the things that he has to say. But what my agenda will be driven strictly by the residents of District 6 and their needs and desires.
So off the bat, what do you think, say, the big three issues are?
The big three, again, with the diverse community, they can be different. But transportation is an issue. That's one of the things I continue to hear. Because in District 6, many of the residents rely on public transportation, and they communicate it could take between 2 and 3 hours to get to and from work, which, doesn't make sense. And impacts their quality of life, the time they're able to spend with their family. But also affordable housing is one. A lot of our residents who are able to work in the district are not able to live in the district, or even to work in Orlando, the city proper, are not able to live in the city. So affordable housing is a concern, but also infrastructure, public infrastructure. We're talking about our stormwater systems as well as our streets, parts of District 6.
Are there some areas that flood, for example?
Oh, yeah. Johnson Village is an area that floods down in the Carver Shores, down Riley, a lot of flooding, with just modest rains. So definitely some infrastructure, stormwater infrastructure and repairing of our roads are some of the main things that we'll be looking at, but also public safety. More recently, I attended a neighborhood association meeting for the Carver Shores neighborhood, and one of the questions was about the human trafficking and wanting to get some more information about how can we protect our children from, human trafficking. So, again, just getting information to the residents before it becomes an issue within the community will be one of the things I'll be focusing on.
Thinking about human trafficking, I know there's been a pretty big statewide effort to crack down on that, but if you look at District 6, I mean, does it seem like in the city of Orlando this is a hotspot for it, from what you know?
I wouldn't say that it was a hotspot, but, whenever someone hears of something like this happening, what I feel we need to get out in front of it and, educate our parents on what to do How can we prevent this from happening to, you know, any of our children? You know, because we have some level of comfort of being able to drop our kids off at the bus stop. Mm-hmm. But we may need to look at how that's done. You know, our children walking to school, you know, things like that. So I hope that it doesn't become an issue here in the city of Orlando. But again, it's about preventing it and giving individuals the information so we can work as a community to keep it from becoming an issue in the city of Orlando.
So just going back to some of the big issues that you're going to dive into and looking at transportation, the city of Orlando in terms of, you know, Mayor Buddy Dyer, he's been very vocal in supporting this initiative to levy a sales tax. It's right. A county initiative, Orange County. Mm-hmm. But Buddy Dyer has been supportive of that and put that money towards transportation, whether it's helping to support more funding for Lynx, the bus service. Is that something that you think is going to help solve this transportation problem?
Well, the transportation issue is large. It's going to take a lot of money. So I'm definitely in favor of a dedicated funding source. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the sales tax that Mayor Demings has been promoting, my stance now is I need to hear more information. Because if we look at, again, the transportation issues that my community has, it's dealing with links. So we need to put more funding in links. We probably need to double the number of buses that we have with links. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe that, you know, we need to increase the efficiency. You know, right now the buses come every 30 minutes. I believe we need to ensure that they're able to come every 15 minutes.
Right.
So again, I haven't made a decision where I am on the sales tax, but I do believe that there should be a dedicated funding source. But again, I'm interested in what does it mean for District 6.
Mm-hmm. And as a commissioner, as a city commissioner representing one part of the city, how much influence do you think you're going to be able to have to try and move things in the right direction, not just for residents in your area, but wherever they may be in the city of Orlando if they're struggling with mass transit and how to get around?
Right. You know, I think my role would be providing the information, you know, from an educational standpoint. And that's one of the things that I committed, my campaign manager and I committed to, is ensuring that the people have accurate information, not information that's skewed or tailored to what I would like to see, but just give them the information of what this means, what do we think this means, and then, you know, allow them to make their own decisions. So I think my role would be one from an education standpoint, but also asking questions that may not be asked. But again, being an advocate for the residents of District 6.
Mm-hmm. Now, housing is a big issue everywhere in Florida. I mean, it's a nationwide problem, affordable housing, especially here in this economy we have in Orlando, where a lot of people work in the service sector. They're not making a lot of money. So housing is a problem. So what do you think you are going to try and do to alleviate some of the struggles or stresses that folks in your district may have?
Yeah, I think, and you know, when we talk about affordable housing, I think we need some bold approaches. One of the things, just in District 6, we did an analysis. There were, I believe, over 100 lots that they were either bank-owned or foreclosed or what have you. So one of the things I'd like us to do is look at those particular lots and see if there's something, some type of development, some type of collaborative or partnership that can come together to ensure that those lots just don't sit vacant, that we have decent and affordable housing on them to increase the housing stock. But also we need to look at creative ideas. You know, one of the things that I'll be looking at is a affordable housing bond program.
Right.
You know, and that's something that I've seen done in other communities. Mm-hmm. And I haven't done all of the research now, so I'm mentioning it without a lot of the details. But I think those are the types of things we know, because we have a health facilities bonding program that, you know, our hospitals are able to benefit from. So, you know, I think we need to do the same for affordable housing.
How would it work?
Again, I'm not sure. I'm still. I'll be doing the research on that.
But if you extrapolate it, or if you use the health facilities bond as as an example, like just kind of walk us through how that works.
Yeah. So a developer would get a bond to be able to build this affordable housing, you know, and it'd be paid off over a period of time. Mm-hmm. But what it does is alleviate some of the need for that upfront capital. and just provides them an avenue for the financing of the affordable housing.
So the city provides the money, essentially?
Well, I'm not sure if it would be the city. I know for the health facilities, it comes through the county.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to look at that.
So that'll be a conversation you may have with Mayor Demings.
Yes.
Or his people.
Yes. But also, I think when we talk about affordable housing, we have to look at livable wages.
Sure.
As well.
Yep.
You know, I'm glad to see that Disney has moved to the $15 an hour. The city mm-hmm. of Orlando, I think over the next couple of years, all city employees, full-time or part-time, will at least make $15 an hour. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a step in the right direction. We need to encourage more corporations to do the same. You know, so affordable housing is one about having the units available, but also wages that will allow someone to be able to afford that housing.
And then again, as city commissioner, how much power do you think you will have to try and, you know, move the ball in the right direction in terms of building wages up or getting encouraging other corporations to boost their minimum wage too?
Well, I think what Mayor Dyer has done, showing that the city is going to increase, you know, we have to be an example, but also communicate and educate them on the need for doing some things. One of the things that that I've heard from the unions who came out and supported my campaign was, you know, when there's some type of government or the city incentivizing or the county incentivizing a program, you know, a community benefit agreement. You know, and that's one of the things, because I run a nonprofit. Anytime mm-hmm. we get grant funding, we have to communicate to the grantor what are some of not just the outputs, what are the outcomes, some of the deliverables, what are we going mm-hmm. to ensure happens. So I would encourage, you know, some type of community benefit agreement with these large corporations who are getting, you know, funding from the city or the county. So we'll know that they have an investment back into the residents in our community that's going to allow us to all of us to grow and have a greater quality of life.
You mentioned at the start of our conversation, Bakari Burns, that you're going to be looking at a district that's diverse in terms of economy and mm-hmm. and I guess even like land use, right? Because you right. have part of iDrive,
right?
And that is a very different scenario from
Holden
a lot
Heights.
Of where folks live, right?
Right?
So how do you kind of, you know, reconcile the needs of those two pretty disparate parts of your community?
You know, I believe it's about bringing us all to the table, you know, because like you said, there's some interests and some priorities that the business district may have
yep.
that may be totally different from the residents. But we have to understand that we're all in this together and see if there's something, if we can kind of marry or pair the interests of the business districts with some of the interests of the community. So, you know, again, just having that discussion, you know, bringing people together, because I think that's when we start to solve problems, is getting the right people at the table and just have frank discussions. We may start off not agreeing, but we need to be open to having the dialogue. Let's have the debate.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the iDrive area, you're looking at a pretty big development coming up in the next few years with Universal building that theme park, right?
Right, right.
Kind of from what you know now, what sort of challenges and opportunities do you think that poses for your district?
Well, opportunities, I think there's an opportunity for Universal to make an investment into the residents and the workers and in our community. For some of the challenges, you know, I hadn't really studied that deal, so there's a learning curve that I have. But I do believe that will be largely a kind of a county mm-hmm. County issue. But, you know, I'm sure there'll be some concerns about transportation,
sure.
You know, traffic and things like that. So I'll be studying that, you know, now, you know, for the last 8 months, I've just been hard on the campaign trail. So those are some of the type things I'll be able to look more into and get the facts, because that's what I'm looking for. I want to know, you know, what are the facts,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then I'll use those to make my decisions and use that to communicate to the residents.
Last time I talked to you, Bakari, was a few years ago, and I was talking to you about your role as CEO of the Orange Blossom Clinic.
Yes.
And healthcare is another thing which, you know, that's a kind of a challenge to be overcome, especially for communities which are struggling financially.
Right.
Do you feel that you can bring some unique insight into your role as city commissioner in terms of what folks might need to kind of get their healthcare needs met in the district?
Yeah, sure. And really, Ryan, we're talking about some of what has been termed social determinants of health. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the issues that we have in our city and that the city government has some influence over impacts our health. Let's just talk about affordable housing.
That phrase, housing is healthcare, comes housing, up time and again.
Housing is healthcare. You know, that's on my door at my office. Housing is healthcare. But, you know, think about someone who's about to lose their housing or can't find adequate housing, the impact that that has on their mental health. You know, and oftentimes we don't make that connection. So understanding the social determinants of health and then understanding and realizing the role that the city government can play in starting addressing some of those social determinants of health. We're talking about the built environment, mm-hmm. you know, wages and things like that. So I'll bring that perspective of knowing what we do here, how it truly impacts the residents and not just from what, you know, what we see all the time, but some of the, again, the health impacts of our residents. Because, again, we need to be focused on improving the quality of life of all residents, not of just District 6, but the city of Orlando in our region in general.
Mm-hmm. Thinking back to the election, it was a pretty close-run thing. I mean, you've got a lot of folks in your district who just didn't vote.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, you know, we have 25,000 registered voters, mm-hmm. and usually about 12% turns out in the municipal race. So I was not surprised because when I looked back, when I first filed a run, that's when the numbers really hit me like, wow, you know, we only have, you know, 15% turnout is a good turnout, mm-hmm. you know, turnout in the municipal.
Yeah, and it's not even your district, right? I mean, if you look at the mayoral race, turnout was pretty low for that, too.
Right, and again, I believe it's because, of, you know, it's just a municipal, but I believe, mm-hmm. you know, next year in the general, I'm hoping that turnout will be a lot higher. But again, what we saw in the first race and in the runoff was consistent with what we've seen over the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Right. Does it concern you, though? I mean, you're talking about local elections are important because you're talking about things right. like infrastructure, education, right. housing, everything that affects people on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. If people aren't, you know, motivated enough to get out and vote, then how do you go about fixing some of those things?
Right, yeah, and that's a great point. And what I would like to do is put a lot of energy in the education of what does it mean to vote? Mm-hmm. You know, because a lot of people feel that they hadn't been well represented and just say, you know what, my vote won't count. And that's what I continue to hear. You know,
well, even when you went door to door?
Door to door. My vote is not going to count, but we continue to tell them it will count. It mm-hmm. will count because if you don't vote, you don't have a say. And so I think it's education. I think that a lot of our systems, like the supervisor of elections, probably can do a better job in getting the word out about voting. I think the Democratic Party, as well as the Republican Party, the local chapters, should have a true push to get, because that was one of the things that I was surprised about. You know, we were talking about getting out the vote, and I said, well, where should that message come from? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the places that I thought it would come from, we weren't hearing anything.
So you're embarking on your first term as an elected official, and I mean, just sort of thinking back to some of those conversations you might have had with folks saying, my vote doesn't count, so why should I bother? Do you feel like, you know, is there some responsibility on your shoulders to prove to those people whether or not they voted in this election, you know, I'm going to do some of these things I promised to do, and therefore
definitely
show you that your vote does count?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, you know, with the outpouring of support. You know, I won this runoff election by 1,000 votes. And to me, that was motivation that, one, I have to do a great job. I have to be responsive, represent the interests of the people. But also, you know, and I don't want this to sound anything but sincere, is I believe that I'm in a position to restore some of the confidence in the community, in their elected officials, the whole election process. So I do feel a responsibility, a great responsibility. But, you know, I continue to pray about it, ask the Lord to guide me, give me wisdom. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that I'm in a position to restore some of the confidence in our citizens. But I'm looking forward to it.
Bakari Burns, incoming commissioner in District 6 for the City of Orlando, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it. And I'd love to come back, you know, and let you know how it's going.
All right, sounds good.
All right, thank you.
Still to come, Orlando Sentinel reporter Jason Garcia examines the taxes that corporations do and don't pay in Florida. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando Sentinel investigative reporter Jason Garcia has been digging into corporate tax loopholes in a six-part series called Big Profits, Tiny Taxes. In his reporting, Garcia reveals that, among other things, 99% of corporations pay no income tax. He joins me now to walk us through his reporting and talk about the implications of the revenue the state of Florida may be missing out on through tax loopholes. Thank you so much for coming back, Jason.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell me about the reporting that you did on this.
Yeah, so the basic premise of this project was to take a look at Florida's corporate income tax, specifically the strategies and tax avoidance techniques that big companies are using to avoid the tax, either entirely or to cut their tax bills by millions of dollars, and then to look at what Florida policymakers could do to stop these strategies if they wanted to. In lots of other states, the legislatures have passed laws to address a lot of what we see here in Florida. The Florida legislature has not done so, so we wanted to try and give readers a sense of what could be done if you thought it needed to be done.
So Florida doesn't have a personal income tax, which is, you know, one of the reasons why people retire here, because that's a draw card. But also, if you look at the reason that a lot of companies come here, a lot of that must have to do with our kind of lenient tax laws, right?
That's the argument you get from businesses and from sort of anti-tax legislators, that the low tax environment is what draws businesses to Florida. Obviously, there's a huge population here. That plays a pretty big role in getting companies to do business in Florida as well. Mm-hmm. But that is certainly the argument for when the legislature has chosen not to act on some of these things. They rarely have substantive debates about corporate income tax stuff, but when they do, that tends to be the argument that a low tax state, a low tax particularly for businesses, because Florida is not necessarily a low tax state for lower income people because so much of its money comes from a sales tax. Mm-hmm. But it is a low tax state for businesses. And the argument for that is that that makes businesses want to do more business here, creating more jobs.
Have you looked into, what the actual job effect is of businesses relocating to Florida and setting up here because of that low tax environment?
Yeah, the trick with that sort of thing is there's just so many variables that go into it. There's no way to tease out, kind of ironically, the Florida Chamber of Commerce, which has lobbied pretty hard against some of the changes you could make to stop some of these tax avoidance strategies. They had a column in the Sentinel where they mentioned that they focus on the number of Fortune 500 companies in Florida. Mm-hmm. But then when our columnists sort of crunched the numbers and you actually adjusted it for per capita basis, because, Florida's got more than 20 million people, Florida actually ranked very poorly on the metric of Fortune 500 companies by when you measured it on a per capita basis. So it's really hard to say or to definitively prove some sort of link. There have been some studies recently that argue that changes in tax policy don't have a huge impact on business investment decisions nowadays, especially because companies have gotten so large in an industry, they're so consolidated, there's so much market concentration, mm-hmm. that tax policy changes aren't sort of significant enough to drive investment decisions for businesses that have that much market power. But it is certainly an area that's the subject of intense debate.
Now, the column from the Florida Chamber of Commerce, that came out after your first article dropped in the series?
Yeah, after the first couple, I think. Sort of that was oriented around one of the sort of biggest policy changes you could make, and we explored this in the second story of the series. The technical term for it is called combined reporting. But what it basically means is Florida is one of a shrinking minority of states that allows companies to file different tax returns for their various subsidiaries, right? Mm-hmm. So there was an example where Dr. Pepper Snapple Group was one company, but it filed multiple tax returns. It filed a different tax return for its bottling division. It filed its syrup division filed its own tax return. And what that does is that creates all sorts of abilities to move money around and minimize your taxes. So one of the most common strategies you'll see is companies will take the rights to their their name and their logo and their other trademarks, and they'll put them in an out-of-state business in Delaware. And then they'll have all their Florida businesses pay that Delaware business for the right to use those logos. And what that does is that lowers the amount of profit the Florida businesses have to pay tax on. Mm-hmm. And then because Florida allows separate reporting, the Delaware business doesn't pay any tax whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And so combined reporting would require essentially one tax return for one business, right? So if you're Dr. Pepper Snapple Group, you're filing one tax return for all your operations. And what it does is it makes it much harder to move money around to reduce your tax bill. Businesses, particularly big multi-state businesses, because that's who this impacts, right? Really dislike this idea. So that's the Florida Chamber was coming out pretty hard against the idea of combined reporting, and that's what sort of motivated that column.
What about the political side of this? I mean, you talk about the fact that some of these laws go back to 1971, and there just hasn't been the appetite from lawmakers in the years since to take a hard look at this and say, maybe corporations should be paying more. What's your sense of the environment we're in right now and whether there might be a change on the horizon?
I don't see that happening. So Tallahassee, as I'm sure you know, the Florida legislature is in Republican control and pretty solidly in Republican control. It's especially in the Florida House. And most elected Republicans are philosophically opposed to any sort of tax increase. They've gone so far as to sort of bind their hands and make it harder for them to vote on anything that could increase revenue. So and they take the position, and this is something businesses urge them to take this position, that repealing a tax loophole or eliminating a tax break that's not working in the way it was intended, that's a tax increase, because by taking that away, some businesses are going to end up paying more tax, even if the tax break is not doing what you wanted it to do to begin with. There is just sort of a very dogmatic, philosophical opposition to anything that will raise revenue. So it is unlikely, in my view, that things will change. It is interesting that when you can talk to legislators and you sort of really sort of walk through some of these strategies, none of them, in my experience, and I've talked to a number of legislators over the years, will defend the individual strategies. They talk about they don't like shell games as a buzzword you'll hear a lot. But then when it comes time to actually do something about it, and businesses point out like, hey, you're raising our taxes if you change this, they generally sort of accede to the business view of that.
Mm-hmm. There have been some what seems like fairly fundamental shifts in philosophy and other issues, though, right? I mean, like, for example, climate change would be one where you're hearing lawmakers who you might not have thought, 5 years ago would be talking about climate change or its impacts now talking about that. I wonder if this is something that with some time and a closer look at some of the impacts of what it means for a company that makes a lot of money to be paying less tax in a state like Florida, if that change could come about.
Yeah, I think that's certainly possible. One place to watch for it if it comes is the increasing sort of focus society is taking on income inequality, right? Mm-hmm. Like the amount of wealth controlled by the top 100th of 1% has grown so disproportionate. There's a lot of research now focusing on the issue that can be bad for economic growth. And one of the things about the corporate income tax is a lot of economists will tell you that, or some economists will tell you that it is the single most powerful tool governments have, or one of the single most powerful tools governments have to combating income inequality. And that's because the very wealthy generate almost all of their income from capital and the ownership of corporations and stock ownership, who is ultimately the stockholders in corporations are ultimately the people paying most of the corporate income tax. The stock ownership is so heavily concentrated in wealthy people that the corporate income tax becomes the tool, a major tool governments have to address income inequality. So in the context of as society becomes more concerned about this, and if there's sort of if there starts to develop a bipartisan agreement that government needs to do more to address income inequality, then yeah, I think you could see a change that way. I haven't seen much sign of that in Tallahassee yet, but sometimes this stuff can happen all at once.
Are there some legislators who are saying, yes, we do need to be spending more time thinking about this or maybe rethinking how we approach this?
Well, for this series, particularly talking on the Republican side, they're in control. Democrats, for the most part, not entirely, but Democrats for the most part are pretty well in agreement that corporate taxes should be more sort of firmer, higher, and more aggressively enforced. Republicans, you know, philosophically, generally are against that. And for the purpose of this story, we reached out to a number of people. Almost nobody on the Republican side agreed to interviews on this. So the Governor Ron DeSantis would not be interviewed. House Speaker Jose Oliva would not be interviewed. Joe Gruters, the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, didn't respond to a request for an interview. The one Republican leader that did was Senate President Bill Galvano. He's a guy from Southwest Florida, kind of the Sarasota area. And we talked for a while, and his sort of position was that he sort of fundamentally believes Florida's low tax environment has contributed to all the growth the state has seen over the last 20, 25 years. But he also did not like the idea that there could be big that tax laws were not being applied equitably, that that companies, big companies that have out-of-state subsidiaries that they can move money to, that have teams of accountants and lawyers that can sort of comb through the tax code to find these weak spots, that can take the state to court and have the resources to litigate until they can get a settlement. He did not like the idea that the tax laws might not be being applied equitably. And he said he was going to do more research to see how this stuff was working. So, and generally what you find is the Florida Senate, where they come from larger districts, and it, partisan control, the partisan divide is not as significant. It's a narrower, I think it's 23 Republicans, 17 Democrats right now. That tends to be the more moderate chamber. So
yeah, that can be a check and balance on some of the more, you know, out there pieces of legislation you see from the House from time to time.
Yeah, that's right. So I would not be surprised to see some sort of hearings or some sort of discussion in the Florida Senate about this. But it would take more movement. Obviously, it would require House leaders deciding that this is something that had to be addressed too.
What's the most surprising thing you learned in your reporting on this series?
You know, probably I knew this number roughly, so this isn't surprising, but it is the single most jarring statistic about Florida's corporate income tax, and that's about only 1% of all businesses even pay any tax at all. And there's the main reason for this is most businesses are the Florida legislature has chosen to exempt entire classes of businesses. So like LLCs, certain types of corporations. And the logic behind this is these the federal government does this, too. They call them pass-through entities. Right. And the idea is you don't have to pay corporate tax. Your profits pass through, but you pay personal income tax on them. But of course, Florida does not have a personal income tax. So these companies are arranged, are essentially, these are profits that go completely untaxed on a state level. And so that plays a big role in so many businesses not paying. That's about 90% of it. The next 9% are these big C corps finding ways to use the tax code to reduce their taxable income to the point where they don't owe any tax on it. In terms of surprising, one thing I will say is what you find is Florida has a lot of laws on the books, and what you realize is the laws are essentially meaningless in terms of companies choose to interpret them however is most favorable to them. Then they gamble that they won't be audited. If they do get audited, they litigate. And so one example of this.
So it's just basically a kind of a cost they build into their
That's exactly
business.
Right. Yeah. And so we talked about these pass-through entities. There's a provision in law that's very specific that like a C corporation, this is the big traditional Pepsi, Coke, these guys are not allowed to use pass-through entities to avoid taxes themselves. Theoretically, in theory, pass-through entities are supposed to be for small businesses, you know, even though there are massive privately held businesses organized as pass-throughs. But what we have found is there are C corps using pass-through entities to avoid taxes. Verizon Wireless, for more than a decade, was set up as a joint venture between Verizon Communications and Vodafone, which is one of the biggest mobile phone companies in the world. It's based in Britain. And it was set up as a pass-through entity, so it passed out its profits. It didn't have to pay corporate income tax. And then Vodafone's lawyers took the position that Florida had no right to tax it whatsoever. And Vodafone was able to avoid at least $23 million in Florida corporate income taxes over 5 years just by just because Verizon Wireless was set up as a pass-through entity. So that's I remember years ago starting to research some of this stuff and being told, no, no, under Florida law, companies can't do this, and thinking, oh, okay, that's clear. And then finding some of these court records, you realize the law, the what the state says the law isn't necessarily how it's actually how companies are actually complying with it.
Once the series finishes, once you publish the last piece, is there more reporting you want to do on this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple of things. One, we'll see what more reaction we get from this, whether or not there are hearings, whether or not legislators file any legislation to try and implement any of the policy options that other states have looked at. And then, you know, the legislative session starts in January, and there will be companies will be lobbying for more tax breaks, right? So right now, Avis Budget Group, the rental car company, is out there lobbying for a tax break. There will be others. So we'll be researching those, and we'll try and make sure readers know what these sort of arcane tax bills, what they would actually do. So we'll spend a lot of time on that. There's a few other areas I'm interested in exploring related to this, too. There's a movement in some states, there has been a movement to make this stuff public. So one of the most challenging things with tax policy generally, and corporate taxes specifically, is all of this stuff is confidential. So all of the records we use, the reason we know eBay paid $18,000 of tax in 1 year is that we pulled them from litigation records. Basically, the Department of Revenue said these companies were using illegal strategies. These companies disputed it, sued, and these normally secret details became public. And so we compiled all of these details from about more than 24 lawsuits over the last decade or so. But there has been so making changes in tax policy, it's often frustrated by the fact nobody quite knows how these tax laws are working, and all of the information is sort of on the business's side. They know their full details.
And that lack of clarity goes for lawmakers too. Presumably,
that's
they're
exactly
not completely
right.
briefed on what's going on.
That's
either.
Exactly right. They're heavily reliant on what companies tell them, right? Mm-hmm. So there's been some movement in other states to make this stuff public. So to make the specific amount of tax that a specific company pays, make that public, and to make other key details like the amount of profit that they are reporting as taxable profit and some of the tax deductions that they are using, to make all that stuff public so you can actually start to make more sense of how your laws are actually working or how changes would actually affect companies. So that is something that businesses lobby intensely against. Mm-hmm. But I'm sort of curious in learning more about how something like that would work, what has been the experience in other states that have tried to implement these kind of laws. So that's something I'll be doing some more research on.
Jason Garcia, investigative reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Still to come, a look back at 20 years of music with Orlando singer-songwriter Mark with a C. We're back in a minute.
I tried to die young, which made me prematurely old. So I made sure to overindulge.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando singer-songwriter Mark with a C has a box set retrospective out and a book called Maybe It'll Be Good. The book and the box set charts the last 20 years of his life creating and performing music. Mark joined us in the studio. Here he is with a song called We're All Gonna Die.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mark with the scene. I've been sent here to deliver a very important message. That message reads as follows. You might as well dance, because one day we're all gonna die. And you should have fun before your untimely demise. You can't avoid the cold hand of death, so you should be out there enjoying yourself. You might as well dance, because one day we're all gonna die. That's right, you could be richer than God, but you're still gonna die. You don't get no online friends in the afterlife. We often forget that life is short, so come over and dance on my front porch. We might as well dance, cause one day we're all gonna die. And that means all of the people in business suits and all the housewives addicted to tiramisu. The French actors like Gerard Depardieu. Well, they can come over and they can dance too. As long as they don't bring their attitude, it won't kill you to be nice, cause you're already gonna die. So cheer up, emo kid! It's only gonna get worse. Wait till you have to do your own taxes and your own laundry. But
as for now, it's all ages and admission is free. Ignore your responsibilities, and if you pick up some jelly beans, then you can come over and dance with me. 9 out of 10 leading dentists agree that you might as well dance, 'cause one day we're all gonna die.
Mark with a C, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you so much for having me. This is an honor and a privilege. I love the station.
Okay, so you've got an autobiography out. It's called Maybe It'll Be Good, My Life as Mark with a C. Kind of a look at the inner workings of yourself.
Yes.
And you've got an album, too, that you launched not too long ago, and you're going to be doing a tour with that?
That's correct. It's a sort of a companion piece. Both are companion pieces to each other. You see, the box set is a compilation of stuff over my 20-year career as portraying this persona named Mark with a C. It's 41 songs that were all voted on by hardcore fans. I only had about 5% say so in what went on it, because who am I to judge what the best I've done in that large of a pile of material? I'm too close to it. I can't say for sure. It's up to the audience to decide. There is potentially an avalanche of unreleased Mark with a C material that's fantastic. That's why the slogan tends to be, maybe it'll be good, which comes from one of the two mottos that I live my creative life by. One is that the first thing off the bat is I never question who's going to get it, because I know I'm not for everybody. I know what I do is very specific. It's very niche. But secondly, there's those days where you just cannot get out of bed if you're a creative type. And if you're a creative type, you're likely kind of empathic. And especially in years like 2019, where you're just absorbing so much negative energy, it's hard to get up and want to make art. And then what are you going to do? Show the world and still be vulnerable and keep purity and honesty while being concerned that the internet's going to drag you or this is not what your family hoped for you. But there's two good things that I learned over these 20 years, which is, one, if what you make is pretty rad, all the distractors will probably shut up. And two, you are your worst critic. So that brings me to the second slogan, which is all you need on those days where you can't get out of bed to make your art is the four words, maybe it'll be good. And that's been enough to kickstart me to keep me making things. They're not always good, but the promise that it might be good for the world or someone or just me, that gets me out of bed every day. Without that slogan, I literally wouldn't have made it to the studio today, my friend.
Where do you get your inspiration for your songs, then?
That's something I address in the book. There's this fun thing that I call the muse. Now, a lot of other people call their inspiration the muse, too. But in my case, it's sort of like this promiscuous Tinkerbell-esque thing that sort of flies up to you invisibly while you're in the shower, while you are nowhere near your tools, you're nowhere near a pen, you're out mowing the lawn or something. And it shows up and it gives you an idea. And then it disappears and you quickly run to whatever your chosen tool is to jot it down. But then you learn there's no such thing as memory. There's only now and there's the decay of now. So what I'm doing is filling in the blanks for what the muse gave me the idea of. And as I age, my short-term memory is getting worse and worse and worse, so I'm filling in more and more and more of those gaps. The inspiration just hits me when I realize, well, that's never been, so it should be. There's a silly Christmas song that I probably shouldn't speak about on the air, but I literally wrote the song within about 2 hours of having the idea, mostly because I thought it existed. I went and searched for it. It didn't exist. And I went, well, if I came up with it, somebody else must be looking for it too. And I made up this incredibly offensive Christmas song. But that was it. I was just kind of filling a void. And right now, it's my most played song on Spotify. Somehow, it's got like 12,000 listens. And I have no idea. I didn't really push it.
So do you keep like a notebook or something with you at all times? Like how are you kind of making notes about stuff that you get ideas for songs for?
For such a Luddite, I'm actually starting to keep notes on my phone, but if I'm writing out lyrics that I want to keep, I will not work outside of a notebook. This is because in 2008, I went to record the album Linda Lovelace for President, and right as I was ready to go, I opened up where the folder that I thought that all the lyrics were in, and they were just gone. Everything was gone. The demos, you name it. I had to kind of immediately rewrite that album from scratch and vomit it onto cassette tape. ever since then, I do not trust it. And I know that nothing physical is permanent either. Don't think that I'm kidding myself by any stretch. But I just won't work without something tangible that I can hold and see and kind of smell and lose and then find later. And you'll find in the book that there's a lot of newer songs that you may think, oh, Mark still got it. That's quite a catchy tune. A lot of these are me running into things from the past and going, well, okay, why not record that now?
Mm-hmm.
I'm constantly surprising myself with these treats that I've left myself, that I've written, and then moved on. And then I come back to them sometimes 12 years later and go, no, I was right. I was right on. Now's the time for the song. It wasn't time for the song when I wrote it, but today is the time.
So do you envisage somebody sitting down and listening to all three records back to back?
Absolutely not. No. And there's – every single side has a specific flow. If you want the absolute – usually the absolute favorite songs, they're kind of all on side one. You've got your one side, that's it. You can play it while you clean up the house or do the dishes. But then there's sort of a heartbreak side. There's sort of a familial side. There's a here's Mark actually singing about his loved ones side. Each side has its own thing going on. It's got its own sort of story arc. So it's really more made for mini adventures. But if you're listening to it on Spotify or Google Play, sure. If you're on a road trip, why not? Play it straight through. Let me know how it works. I haven't done it. I haven't had 2 hours and 15 minutes to set aside to do it since it came out.
Mm-hmm. And so your live shows are going to be every single song on the compilation, you think?
Oh, gosh, no. I'm only human, and I'm not the Ramones. There's only one of me. So, no, it'll be songs peppered from throughout the career. In the last 5 years, I've been focusing on my newer material because I think it's better, and that's where my heart's at. And the more indie-er material that you are, the more contagious it becomes for your audience. But I've also received a number of emails and quite a bit of communique over the years going, Mark, we really miss, you know, the entire first 15 years. So I'm going to start reintroducing many of those older songs and especially finding out which ones still apply today, because, boy, are there a lot of songs that don't. Not everything ages well, and they don't issue you a pamphlet ahead of time. Mm-hmm. You've just got to write and hope that you are right.
So what does the next few months look like then? You're going to be fairly busy touring with this retrospective?
The first date is actually going to be the tail end of February, and that's the only date I can currently announce right now. I'm going to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to play at a convention called MarsCon. I've been there before, but past that, it's actually going to be an interactive tour, and there will be a day that is coming soon where a tour form is going to be released. And you, yourself, can fill it in and explain, here's how long I've been listening to you. I would either like to host or help host a Mark with a C show. But importantly, I don't want to do it in traditional venues. I don't want to do it in rock clubs. And if I can do it in your house, I'd rather do that. I want to go specifically to the people who have continued to buy my records in, say, Peoria. I want to go to them and thank them, and not make it about commerce. Now, I'll pick between 10 and 15 of these and announce them sporadically through the year. But it won't be a traditional tour. I've not seen it done this way. This is the way that makes the most sense for me to do it. I need time to recharge. I need time to myself. I need time to have time around loved ones. Because I think what your biggest takeaway from the end of the book might be that I didn't leave very much time to be Mark Serdorius' private citizen, and I have to learn how to do that if Mark is going to survive. Either Mark. Mark Serdorius or Mark with a C.
So you really don't know where you're going to be because you haven't kind of figured that out yet.
No, some things are already booked. I'm just not at liberty to say. But we're going to pick between 10 and 15 fans to actually host and help these things take place. And I already know some of the states, and they're... It's going to be a strange-looking tour on paper, but it's kind of exactly in line with how I've done everything. I don't go where I'm not wanted. So in this case, you have the chance to go, everybody in this building is here and wants what you do. And that's so rare to get to book a tour that way, and I'm so thankful to have listeners that like that kind of interaction, and I'm glad to have cultivated it, and really, they make me. This isn't just being said for radio either. I say this constantly. If there's nobody there to receive it, give me feedback and interact, it ceases to be Mark with a C. When you take away the interaction, Mark with a C does not exist.
Well, Mark with a C, the book is called Maybe It'll Be Good, My Life as Mark with a C, and that's also the title of the retrospective compilation as well. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And to take us out, a song called Low Rent Truman Show.
After years of speculation, conspiracy theories, and tinfoil hats, it turns out the Illuminati wasn't rumor, it was fact. And the governments were involved, and all of Hollywood too.
Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Advent Health. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
All of us control everything you've ever known. For example, Santa Claus was just a construct to prop up.